You're just gonna have to pretend the audio intro happened because my iPad's not hooked up.
Boom, boom, boom,
boom. You're listening to Please Be Reasonable. It's our new audio intro.
I'll try to do better.
No, it's good.
You're listening to Please Be Reasonable, where we seek to speak humbly and passionately about things that matter and things that don't.
Hello, hello. Welcome to Please Be Reasonable. I'm your co-host, Sam.
And I'm your co-host, Josh.
Josh. Good to be with you tonight, man.
Good to be with you.
We have a special guest tonight, back for the second time. Mr. Agnostic Andy's in the house.
Hey, how's it going?
Repeat guest on the show.
Yeah.
Yeah, how's it going? Good to see you guys.
Yeah.
Good to be back.
Thanks for coming back. Yeah. We had Andy on a few episodes ago to talk about kind of his story, and we're going to talk some more today.
Yeah, so we've been continuing the conversation, and by we, I mean Josh has been continuing the conversation with Andy. We've been having an in-depth, you guys have been going back and forth about morality and the necessity of religion within that context, and so we had our episode on morality a few back at Andy's suggestion, and we thought it'd be cool if you jumped on and just kind of push back on some of that and talk through just different aspects of that. That's right. Right?
Yeah,
that's
awesome.
Where we're at?
Yeah.
What we're doing?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Did you have any initial feedback out of the gate from our previous episode? Anything you felt like you wanted to press pause and interject in something?
Anything you need to do to exonerate yourself on where we misrepresented you terribly?
I don't know. Maybe a little bit. I mean, it was, like you said in the episode, I re-listened to it last week, and you said at one point, you're like, I think we agree with each other too much, and I think maybe it definitely would help to have a contrasting voice, just have the conversation with somebody else in the room that maybe doesn't fully agree.
Yeah.
Because I felt like in our original discussion, talking about other stuff, just the fact that I was there particularly brought out some stuff in you, Sam, where you kind of shooting some Reformed Baptist theology at me, and it was pretty cool. So, you know, so having a counter voice present sort of threw that out, I feel like. So maybe having the conversation with me here, maybe we can, I don't know, come up with something cool.
Yeah, so I think what we're kind of going to do is talk about different views on the origins of a moral system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and most of our listeners will be familiar with, you know, basic religious morality, generally for Christians based on the Bible. And we talked kind of some of that last week, or last episode, about kind of some of the nuances of different cultures interpreting that. I was reading Mere Christianity, and C.S. Lewis talked about, he views morality in an analogy of a fleet of ships. Are you familiar with this, Sam?
No, I don't remember this. And I've definitely read that book a couple times.
I don't remember that.
It's been so long, so I was just thought I'd reread it in context of all this other things I read Sam Harris's book on Andy's suggestion. I've been listening to Jordan Peterson podcasts. He's kind of an interesting guy, and I thought I should reread C.S. Lewis's thoughts on some of the same topics. He views morality as analogous to a fleet of ships. And there's three different things that it concerns. The first is that the ships don't run into each other. So basically, like, human interactions with other humans. Like, to be moral, you have to not collide with other humans. And then secondly, you also have to have your own ship interworking properly. So your own personal character. And he's, you know, he says they interact together because if you have your ships running into each other, they're not going to stay in good working order. And if your ships aren't in good working order, they're not going to be able to keep from running into each other. But then he also views a third point of the ships all have to be going to the right place. And so he views kind of the first point of ships not running into each other as something that a lot of non-religious cultures agree on. And then the other points, especially the ships all going to the right place, is where he brings in a more spiritual significance of what is humanity supposed to be striving towards.
That's interesting. It almost sounds like that could be used for a secular morality at the same time.
Yeah, and I'd love to talk about kind of some of the interesting overlaps between Christian morality and secular morality, but first let's dig into some ideas of secular morality. I think we kind of hinted at this on our previous podcast, that a lot of people, especially steeped in Christian morality, kind of think that initially that there would be no secular morality.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of, like, just the common things said in the Christian subculture is, how could you possibly know right from wrong without Jesus?
Yeah.
And that was kind of the joke of the whole Penn Jillette video we played last time.
But it's a common way of thinking, and I remember thinking that way.
And so there is a, kind of a Nietzschean view of purpose and morality. You want to talk maybe a little bit how you would define that general outlook on life?
My general outlook on
The general outlook of Nietzsche, of purposelessness, or...
I don't claim to be an expert on Nietzsche, but I would say, at least for myself...
You're enough of an expert to say Nietzsche instead of Nietzsche. So.
I've been listening to a lot of Jordan Peterson, and he says Nietzsche.
But he's also Canadian, so I don't know.
That's true.
That matters.
Yeah, he does mispronounce a lot of weird
words. He's all about Nietzsche.
Yeah. But when I first kind of rejected the Christian worldview, I kind of fell into that because... The knee-jerk reaction to losing the religious perspective of my morality comes from God. The knee-jerk reaction is, well, then there is no morality. Basically, everything is relative. Like, that's kind of, I feel like that's kind of a natural knee-jerk reaction. I don't know. It's not nihilism, but no, what? So when I first went through this, I liked Jean-Paul Sartre and his idea of about from his book Existentialism and Humanism, and about how I basically, in the absence of religion, I'm left to kind of basically define morality for myself, more or less. And that's where I was at, for a long time, until I read Sam Harris's book. And now I would say that we can talk objectively about, objective secular morality. Like, that's actually a thing, and that's not something that I thought even like 2 years ago, So it's kind of a new thing for me.
Mm-hmm. So before we get into that, when you get into kind of everything's relative view, sometimes that can take you to nihilism, nothing matters, or it could take you kind of to like hedonism, nothing matters, so I might just pursue pleasure.
Right.
But you have found through Sam Harris's view in his book, The Moral Landscape specifically, he kind of pushes back on everything being relative.
Right. And that's one of the main reasons why I think this conversation even matters. It's not just an interesting philosophical discussion. It actually has some important implications and some utility. And moral relativism is one of the big ones. Moral relativism, which says that, it's real easy to pick on like radical Islamic cultures, because it's kind of a low-hanging fruit, but it makes the point well. So you observe these cultures doing things like genital mutilation and making women wear cloth bags, as Sam Harris liked to say it, in the desert, and denying women education and all these kinds of things. And, but we can't criticize that. That's their culture. That's their worldview. And everything's relative, and we can't criticize that. We just have to leave them alone. And so moral relativism has a way of insulating people. It allows you to tolerate certain behaviors and things. And insulates those kind of things from criticism. So, like, we can't criticize the practice of general excision because that's their culture. But when you adopt an idea like Sam Harris's, it kind of gives you the it gives you the ability to criticize them, like, objectively. Like, you could say, no, that actually is wrong. And, you know, we can actually say that objectively. You know, but under a moral relativistic kind of view, you can't do that.
And he arrives, and now, you know, for our, you know, listener's sake, a Christian morality would also criticize that. But mm-hmm. he's arriving at that from a kind of secular foundation. So mm-hmm. why don't you describe just kind of the basics of Harris's moral view?
Okay. Well, really quick, before you do that, I think it's important to note that when we're talking about the moral system of any particular faith, we're saying the basis of that is revelation. So a Christian morality, Christian argument for morality would come from the basically saying we have an objective third party to define right and wrong in the revelation of God through Scripture, which would be the basic stance of any mm-hmm. religious morality. But you don't need a revelation. You don't need a third party.
Right. Yeah, I certainly don't think so. So, basically, first of all, what caveat, I don't claim to be it's complicated, okay? And I'm not a dummy, but I feel like it's his whole book and his whole argument, I think I get it, and I also think that maybe he, like I said in the last time we talked, like, there's more in there that really needs to be there. And he brings in things that I don't think necessarily need to be said. But there's a lot of stuff that's kind of hard to understand. But I think I can give kind of a basic description that's useful for this conversation. And I think that one of the most useful things that he said in his whole book was when he talked about the spectrum of human experience. And he gave the two extreme examples of the woman in Africa and the upper class white family. So if you picture a spectrum, like a straight line, and on one end is like the negative extreme, and the way that he describes an example of a life that's about as little well-being as you could have as a human being. And he describes the situation where there's a woman in the jungle, whatever. And she's in her mud hut where she's lived her whole life in the jungle with these terrible insects and terrible weather conditions. And her life is miserable. And she's white. Right now she's witnessing her daughter being raped by her son, who's being forced to do this by a gang of drug-addled, machete-wielding people. And she watches her daughter die, and then she runs out of the hut, and she's running through the jungle barefoot, and she's being pursued, and she's probably going to die. She's about to get hacked to death with machetes. Like, that's about as bad a life as you can imagine. And then on the opposite end of the spectrum, there's the upper class person who's married to the most intellectually stimulating, interesting person that they've ever met, and they're deeply in love, and they have a beautiful family, and they both have careers that are interesting, and they have disposable income that allows them to experience a wide range of enjoyable activities and to give back, to engage in philanthropic work. And if you ask them, like, they would say, there's no possible way that I could live a better life. Like, my life is just so great. Like, so you have a spectrum of human experience from about as bad as it gets to as good as it gets. And his argument is, in essence, if you acknowledge that there is a difference between those two human experiences, then you agree with his argument. In other words, that's it. That's the argument. If there is an objective difference between this life and you know, both ends of the spectrum,
and where one is better than the other.
Yes. There is a broad range of human experiences and varying degrees of human well-being that can be enjoyed in this life. And these two examples present the two extremes. And if you acknowledge that there is a difference and that you would prefer one over the other, then you are agreeing to his argument, basically.
Which is that we should seek, that morality should means, morality means seeking.
It means that which supports well-being. It's that simple. So it's different than that which is in accordance with God's will. So it's a totally different definition of the word moral. So we're working with two different definitions. But that's his argument, in a nutshell.
And so something is immoral if it decreases human well-being.
If it moves you toward the negative end of the spectrum.
Or it's moral if it's an action that increases.
Basically. Now, this is a vastly oversimplified version.
Right.
There's so much more to it and so much nuance. But that's basically it. And I don't think we need to really... That's enough to work with, I think, in the context of this conversation.
No, yeah, I dig it.
So the question is, you know, as a believer, so the two things I see as far as the value of even having this conversation is, one, to combat moral relativism, because I think it's a bad thing and it should not be a thing, because it insulates bad human well-being limiting things from criticism. And therefore prevents positive change. And the second thing, less important, is in the context of believers speaking with non-believers and just not having this patronizing, like, you can't have morality because you don't have God. You know, like, let's clear this up. You know?
Yeah.
So that's those two things are the value that I see in even having this conversation.
Yeah, so let's clear the air with I think the first thing. It's definitely possible to have an objective moral standard outside of Christianity, right? Like, that's a dumb thing
that
even needs to be said, but totally needs to be said.
Well, and something that I found striking when I was reading back through some of your Christianity the other day is one of C.S. Lewis's building blocks for his argument towards Christianity is universal human conscience, that things are right and wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And he points that, like, he builds a case for, you know, pointing that to a God existing and eventually to the Christian God and so forth. But it's like...
He also calls, I think in that same section, he calls Muslims Mohammedans.
Yeah, I don't know. But they called them in Britain in the 50s, I don't know. But I thought it was interesting that, like, on the one hand, sometimes we want to use, oh, everybody knows that things are right and wrong. We want to use that as an argument for a universal morality. But then, like, you know, every culture has recognized certain basic moral truths. And then act surprised that people who aren't Christians recognize basic moral truths.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And I guess part of, you know, you run into various questions and conflicts when you talk about these things. So, you know, one thing somebody might say, yeah, that's great. Let's, you know, things are immoral if they decrease well-being. Let's seek to increase well-being. That's fine. But, you know, why should I still not just do whatever I want?
Yeah, that's interesting because I know you just listened to that that episode of Sam Harris's podcast with Will McCaskill about effective altruism. And I wish that they talked about this, because it would be interesting to hear McCaskill's reaction to what, like, everything that you're saying seems predicated on this concern for other people.
Mm-hmm.
So why are you concerned about the well-being of other people in the first place? It'd be interesting to hear his response. But yeah. So the question is what now?
Yeah. So, yeah, let's say I'm saying, why are you concerned about the well-being of other people?
That's a good question. And I wonder if it's hard for me to answer because I don't know that I can be separated from my upbringing. So it'd be interesting to ask somebody who didn't come up in our cultures? Because I honestly wonder if, and this is one of Jordan Peterson's big criticisms of Sam Harris's view, it's like he saying that he borrows basically Western like mm-hmm. Christian values and then assigns secular explanations to them.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not a believer, but I think that I still do have some leftover feelings, you know. I mean, I was brought up to be concerned about the well-being of other people, you know. And I don't know that I could, in a manner of secular, yeah, I don't know if I could ever shake myself mm-hmm. free of.
Yeah, because under a, you know, Judeo-Christian kind of civilization, there's this kind of foundational view of universal human value that Jordan Peterson talks about, be connecting to the image of God. All humans are created in that image. So all human lives have value. I feel like when I listen to Sam Harris and that episode with, Will McCaskill, that they kind of are arriving at a similar view based on the idea of consciousness that...
In Sam Harris's book, he doesn't just say morality is that which supports well-being. His phrase is that which supports the well-being of conscious creatures.
And yeah, because we can, conscious creatures can experience suffering mm-hmm. and pain.
And that's a big part of McCaskill and Peter Singer's argument about, like, they're vegetarians, but they talk about, like, it's more moral to eat animals that are less conscious. Like, fish are less conscious and experience less pain than other animals, so it's more moral. So yes, consciousness is the basis of a lot of the secular mm-hmm. Perspectives on the morality question. Sure.
Yeah, and it's really interesting for me to listen to guys like Harris and McCaskill and there's this whole movement called effective altruism, which is basically kind of these people approaching life from a secular humanist perspective and, you know, having determined this desire to do good to other humans and decrease suffering in the world and trying to logically and rationally figure out, you know, how they can maximize that. And so they have, what is it, GiveWell,
mm-hmm.
I think.
GiveWell, yeah. And that ranks charities based on their effectiveness.
And so, you know, they're real big right now on malaria nets and decreasing malaria. And, you know, they're, and some of the, and in that, the podcast with Harrison McCaskill, you know, McCaskill is really devoted to maximizing the amount of good he can do in the world
yeah.
and how little he can spend on himself.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
To give away and do the most he can to others. And I find that so fascinating because that's like the same thing that a lot of us arrive at from Christian theology.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's definitely different motivations.
Yeah.
There's some different, like the, you know, eternity obviously isn't a concern of a secular person. So there are no, you know, eternal implications on these kind of behaviors.
Yeah. But, you know, the line of, you know, Shane Claiborne and David Platt, book Radical.
I'm not familiar with them.
All these.
You don't know Claiborne?
Mm-mm.
Oh, you'd be into him, man. He's a Christian hippie political activist guy.
Sweet.
And he's all, you know, he's very into generosity to the poor.
He's currently on a campaign to see the death penalty ended in the United States.
And even Ron Sider, Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger, all advocating for, you know, based on the teachings of Jesus, love your neighbor as yourself, you know, feed the hungry, clothe the needy, that Christians have a duty to, you know, be as frugal as they can, live on as little as they can, and give away as much as they can. And yeah, there is an eternal element, but I just found the things that Harris and McCaskill were wrestling with in that podcast is similar to a lot of things that Christians mm-hmm. wrestle with on how to, you know, maximize what they're doing with their lives. And I think it's really interesting, too, I think about, like, kind of the humanism view of the world and, you know, trying to increase human progress, decrease human suffering, how that seems to have so much overlap with Christianity. You know, even like, you know, Jesus feeding the hungry with his miracles, healing the sick. And now, you know, with science and technology, we decrease famine, we increase food yields, we come up with ways to help blind people see and, you know, fix these various diseases. You know, even like, we don't really control the weather in the sense of Jesus calming the storm, but we, you know, are learning to predict weather and building better buildings that can, you know, withstand severe weather and earthquakes. And
I actually saw an article on Facebook saying that contrails control the weather for the Illuminati, so I think you're wrong on that one.
I'll get back to you on that. But yeah, and you know, and it's just, yeah, I don't know, it's so fascinating, the this overlap between working, I guess it's in some ways considered more of a progressive Christianity, but working for a better world because of what we believe Jesus teaches, how we are to love our neighbors as ourselves, and the effective altruism movement of let's decrease suffering for as many humans as possible. Even on the level of consciousness in general, I was just seeing a post on Slate Star Codex. Somebody in the comments was talking about some subgroup are even into like decreasing animal suffering to the point of like theorizing about ways to like eliminate predators ecosystems.
Oh, okay.
Because like lions harm antelopes and stuff, and like
a little bit much.
Suggesting like maybe we can re-engineer lions to eat plant food.
Yeah,
and I'm like, okay, that's the lion in the eating straw in Isaiah. Like, it's like there. It's just interesting, this drive to increase human well-being.
And yeah, and there was another episode of the Harris podcast where he interviewed some doctors who's they're developing lab-grown meat to, and the motive, one of the prime motivations being to decrease the suffering of animals. That's coming down the pipes. That'll be interesting.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. So, yeah.
Laboratory grown bacon.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a question, Andy. So you said this thing where you feel like the humanist in his morality is not going to have an eternal motivation. And I get that in the sense of, like, you know, there's no, like, store up treasures in heaven aspect. But it seems to me that a greater concern with the larger, just, like, humanity, human development, like worldwide humankind development, that seems like an eternal motive to me.
Yeah, you can say that, I guess, like the propagation of the species.
Yeah, yeah. Kind of like this base, I'm part of something more than just me, I'm part of human existence, so I should help human existence happen.
Yeah, that's fair. And I guess, you know, like flourishing of the human species is like heaven, and the death and suffering of the species could be equated with hell, kind of a thing.
Yeah, and I'm not even necessarily going that far in it, but just, to me, it's interesting to note this idea that morality feeds to something bigger than the individual. Mm-hmm. Because it goes back to your question of, like, why do I care about other people? I think, from a purely secular perspective, you could make a really good, you know, evolutionary biology argument for why we should care about other human beings, yeah, because that propagates the species.
And here, to defend Harris, he argues a little bit towards the idea that, like, you would want to live in a society that has certain moralities. Like, even if you only care about your own well-being will be better if you live in a society that, you know, where murder is not allowed, where certain fairness and norms are expected.
Andy, do you watch Rick and Morty?
I just started watching Rick and Morty. I've seen like two episodes.
So you're at the beginning still?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I don't want to spoil anything. It doesn't spoil anything. There's an episode that centers around the kids, the brother and the sister, essentially wanting to live in a Mad Max world for a season of time to help them process stuff going on at home. And you just made me think of it. They're like, we want to live in a world of morality. But they were in like, nah, we want a world where we can drive around the desert and shoot people for a while. But, so really quick, here's why I said that. Have you guys heard of the concepts of calling a culture an individualistic culture versus a collectivistic culture.
Sure.
Yeah.
So I finished reading this book recently. We've talked about it a little bit, called Misreading Scripture Through Western Eyes. And it's the main premise of the book is basically trying to show Western Christian theologians where they read Western social mores, so unspoken aspects of our worldview,
focus on the individual.
Yeah, into the scripture. And so they list all these different Western mores, which are the subconscious aspects of our worldview, and show how we read those into aspects of scripture. And that's one of the biggest ones, is that Western culture is inherently individualistic and values the importance of the individual, whereas Eastern cultures tend to be collectivistic and value the overarching thriving of the village society culture. And so what I think is interesting is when we say, well, yeah, like Christianity arrives at this similar morality through Revelation, well, that makes sense because, like, the narrative of the Christian story is that God is preserving for himself a people. Like, he's speaking about something larger than individuals. We love to westernize that in American Christianity and say God has a plan for your life, you know. But the reality is most of the promises or things in Scripture where we assume it's about us as an individual, a lot of those are really God speaking about a large group of people that are like his collection of people, right? And so, like, Christianity was born in an Eastern collectivistic culture, and so it makes sense that the morality that would come out of Christianity places the betterment of the whole tribe over the betterment of the individual. So, like, self-sacrifice, like, for the betterment of the people, like, makes sense in a Christian worldview. But I also, like, I look at what you're talking about this secular pushback of rebellion against moral relativism, and I almost see that as, like, that's a pushback against a sour aspect of a hyper-individualistic Western worldview. To just say, man, just to give yourself sovereign ability to discern what is best all the time and just pursue that, that's not good. I want to push back against that and be a part of something bigger. Which seems in some way to me to just be like a critique of Western individualism, like as a moral function. I don't know if that makes sense.
It's interesting. It makes sense. Sure. Sure. Yeah, I like that. Wish I had something more insightful to say. I agree.
Oh, this is what I do to Josh all the time. He's like, this isn't in our notes, but what do you think about this? And he's like, well, I have nothing prepared to say to it, so.
It sounds like a good book. What was it called?
I want to talk to you about this off air, but I actually, like, really want you and Josh to read that book and let us come back and talk about it, because I think going back, knowing, like, the common theological education we had, like, I think this book would be really challenging for you in some good ways. I think it would be really cool to discuss.
That'd be interesting. What if they have an audiobook for it?
I don't know. I had to read it for seminary.
I can't remember the last time I read a book. I paint, and I listen to audiobooks all day. So that's how I get
well,
by
you,
it.
Do you have Audible, or are you just
strictly Audible.
On that? So an Audible or something.
Audible and podcasts.
Yeah. Probably on there. I'll text you the name.
That sounds like a perspective that would be very healthy for to be more widely adopted. Because the focus on the individual definitely is not very helpful. It doesn't lead to much good.
So let me ask this then, and not to be, like, picky, but I want to hear you chew on this. So in my mind, some of Harris's definition, like some of his initial argument about the difference of human experience and, like, some of your definition of what human flourishing will look like will be affected by whether you lean more individualistic or more collectivistic. Because there will be certain life experiences that are incredibly negative for the individual and yet have positive outcome for the collective, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, to put it in a, like, from a faith perspective, you know, the individual experience of, you know, pick any Christian martyr you want. John Wycliffe is pretty terrible, but the collective benefit for the total church is insane, like that sacrifice. And so how do you weigh that out, right? Where individual betterment was lessened, collective betterment was increased. How does that work out on the moral scale?
Well, first thing that comes to mind is Will McCaskill, really. I mean, he picks a level of income. Like, he makes this a pretty substantial income. He's a professor at, Cambridge or something over in Britain, I think. But he keeps, like, a basic subsistence level of his income and then gives everything else away. And he lives a very simple, you know, life. And he foregoes a lot of material comforts and material things and just gives that up because it's, you know, it's being put to better use elsewhere. And that's a sacrifice. But I don't think that those kind of things really bring real, deep, lasting enjoyment, you know, in life in the first place. So I think that to a certain degree, I think we'd all be better off if we had less, you know, and sacrificed more. I think we would actually enjoy our lives more. And I think McCaskill's a good example of that. It's a really interesting podcast. Y'all ought to listen to it. It's, I think it's episode 44 of Sam Harris's podcast. What is it? The Good, the Bad, and the Moral, or something like that.
Something like that.
Yeah. Wait, that one was ours. That was our episode title. Did we independently invent the same title as Harris?
No. That'd be awesome. I was confused, but no, it's in the 40s. I know that.
Okay, I'll check it out. Finish what you're saying.
But yeah, also, I would say, just to clear up, just because I know we haven't talked a ton about Harris's view in his whole book. I mean, there's so much in there. And the reason why the book is called The Moral Landscape might kind of have something to do with this. And it's that he's not making an argument for, like, the perfect society. And this is what it should look like. And this is what it should be based on. And he just kind of, he's talking about some general principles to say, this society might look different than this society. But if you picture all of human societies on a plane, it'll look like, you know, wavy and bumpy because there will be peaks and there'll be valleys. And he's not making an argument that we should all be on the same peak and all of our moral systems should be identical and we should all be have this balance of individualism versus collectivism. But it's that, it's not that. It's not the perfect peak. It's about just recognizing that there will be a clear distinction between peaks and valleys. And to say that this peak might look different than this peak, but regardless, being on either one of those peaks is better than being in a valley. And based on these criteria, and based on this outlook on morality.
I guess my thing is, I wonder if there's a circumstance where, because of the differentiation between the betterment of the individual and the betterment of the collective, if something can simultaneously be a peak and a valley. And so here's what I mean by that. So we'll use the professor as an example. Which, by the way, total side note, but Rick Warren, purpose-driven life guy, does the exact same thing. It's actually, like, insanely cool, like, how humbly that guy lives versus what ridiculous amounts of money his books made. But anyway, like, we could all easily assent to the idea that, okay, so this dude lives, because of his salary and his accomplishments and those things, has the ability to live at 1,000% of the poverty level. And so instead, he chooses to live, you know, 100% above it instead of 1,000%. And then he divvies the rest of that out. That is an easy, obvious moral good, because he's sacrificing, like, he's lowering his standard of living to better others. And it's a sacrifice for him, but it's a sacrifice that still leaves him at a peak. Like, he's still experiencing life and able to live and eat and have shelter and all those things.
And to and just not to stop you, but to be just to kind of, he talks about this, and basically I think he would say that if he were to reduce his lifestyle any further, it would actually detract from his ability to do good. So like he talks about the balance of like okay, I can't justify putting in extra hours at work to make more money or whatever for it's like balance. Like if I were to donate my time for free versus going to work to make money, it's like donating my time for free, I'm doing good, and here I'm just making money, but I can actually in the end do more good with the amount of money that I make at work. So it's like a balancing act of because he has the ability to kind of control that.
Yeah.
He's trying to maximize his effect on the world, not just giving away some and then still trying to live comfortably. Like he's genuinely trying to give as much as he can while still
being able
to give as much as he can. You know?
Yeah, I wasn't trying to like downplay that aspect of like where he's like, I was just picking a number at random. I guess my point is there a point where his sacrifice for the benefit of others could cause enough suffering in his own life that it creates a valley, right? So if the dude is starving himself to make sure that food is available for others, like, that has a collective moral good, right? Like, you know what I mean? Like, when you wash it out, it's like, okay, so more people are benefited from that, but that lowers, that puts him into the realm of valley. And so, you get what I'm saying? I'm stumbling over the words, but do you think there's a place where, because of the individualistic collectivistic divide, that you could have a peak and a valley at the same time?
I don't know. I have to chew on that. I think he would. I think he would say that giving to the point where it like puts you out of commission would just not be an effective, a good way to live your life.
Yeah.
You know, you reduce your own effectiveness. I mean, if you're doing this willingly, then I think that that would be a good way to reduce your effectiveness and your ability to do good, to put yourself out of commission like that. So, I mean, you could do that, but I would say that would be dumb.
Yeah.
And that kind of makes me think of going in two directions at once. Reminds me of what we were talking about in our email thread about moral paradoxes, like the train analogy.
Classic train.
Yeah.
So there's a classic moral paradox of there's a train coming down the track and it's headed for five people stuck to the track, and you can flip a switch that will... There's another sidetrack that only has one person on it. So do you let the train go, hit the five people, or do you flip it and hit the one person?
Mm-hmm. What's the right moral thing to do? And I was thinking about this after our exchange. And I think that the example that I gave at the beginning about the spectrum, I think that kind of is a way to make sense of that particular paradox in light of Harris's argument. Because basically, I feel like no matter what you... Like I said in our email chain that it's basically just like a... It's an anomaly, and it's that kind of situation where it's just an unfortunate event that has no good outcome. So you can't really make a moral judgment per se, regardless of what decision is made. But I think a better way to think about it would be you're basically, no matter what decision you make to flip the switch to kill the one person or to flip the switch to kill the five people, on that spectrum that I described earlier about the woman that's being chased with machetes and then the upper class people, you're basically moving along the spectrum in both directions simultaneously, regardless of what you do. Because you are obviously decreasing the well-being of some people, including yourself, and increasing the well-being of another person simultaneously. And it is just it's an unfortunate situation. I think that's all that really needs to be said about it, personally.
And then I was saying, one thing I was thinking of, one way out of moral paradoxes is voluntary sacrifice. If you can't determine if it's moral to force someone else to bear a cost, and where there's a trade-off, but if you choose to voluntarily sacrifice and accept the cost yourself, then you're, you know, so if you decide to throw yourself in front of the train, if that was an option, then, you know, then you've eliminated the paradox. And I think kind of part of our kind of overall discussion here is the question of how much is voluntary sacrifice kind of a religious idea, you know, where Jesus is kind of the ultimate example of that, and how much can you, you know, arrive to that same conclusion through the secular view, like McGaskill does with his effective altruism.
So, really quick, that's just a way better of communicating. Better way of communicating what I was trying to get at, because I feel like that's what I was talking about. Is if you make that choice and you sacrifice in that moment, it's obviously moving the scale, right? Like benefiting
for others.
Yeah, but significantly crapping up your own personal scale. Like,
yeah, and I think that regardless of the perspective that you bring to a situation like that, I mean, if you look at movies, you know, regardless of whether you're religious or secular, you know, you cheer for the guy who sacrifices himself for the collective, you know, the guy who takes the bullet or you know, gives himself up for the other person. And we all have the impulse to cheer that person, regardless of whether we're religious or not. So the question is, what motivates us to cheer that from a secular perspective?
Survival benefit. Right?
I mean, you could definitely make that argument from like an evolutionary standpoint.
Yeah. Even just the sociological standpoint. Like, it just makes sense for moving the species forward.
Yeah. Yeah, so regardless of our motivations, we all have the impulse to cheer in a situation like that. And, Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed.com. So you have a really well-formed moral lens that allows you to evaluate the rightness and wrongness of certain situations. I feel the need to give you a really important moral quandary while we have you present.
Is it about the avocado?
No, we're not going to. That's a dark part of my past. We don't talk about that anymore. Okay. So, is it a moral good? Does it further human benefit, or does it create more human suffering to put pineapple on pizza?
I guess it depends on whether the consumer has an allergy or not. How they feel about gluten.
You know, you were the first person I ever met who didn't eat gluten.
You know, what can I say? I'm a special guy. I'm one of those people.
Does a pineapple have any consciousness?
You know that's the thing, right?
Fruitarians, man.
So I want to point out one other thing real quick. I don't want to, we're not over on time yet, but I do want to ask one other thing, and it was a different concept that came up in this book about different cultural ideas, and so I'm just going to have to explain this concept from the book, and you haven't read it, you're just going to have to trust me that it's a thing.
Okay.
But I'd love just to hear your kind of reaction to it and your thoughts on it. So one of the arguments it makes is that
Western... And this is, just to clarify for listeners, this is the book Misreading Scripture Through Western Eyes.
Yes. One of the arguments that it makes is that Westerners value a morality system that's based on objective rights and wrongs, and the personal ability to introspect and discern those rights and wrongs. That's the way we understand and create a morality system. But that's not the universal method of creating morality systems. They argue that a more Eastern form of morality, because it's not individualistic culture, because it's a collectivistic culture, instead of landing on absolute objective right and wrong and the personal ability to discern those things, you land on a culture that's shame honor based, which essentially gives the collective, it gives the community the ability to publicly discern things that are right and wrong for the individual. So there's no need for introspection. So you act, and you act in a way that the people around you will approve of or disapprove of, and that determines the rightness or wrongness of the particular action. And they go on to show how basically that's the commonly accepted way of determining morality in the biblical world, and like you see that working out in Bible stories and those things. Hmm. But I guess my question is, what are your thoughts on that as a system? Do you think that's an inferior system of creating morality than what we've been discussing?
Well, my first reaction is that I see how it could make a society work. It obviously has utility, you know, something provides a structure and a guide for behavior. But you have to, when you look at a lot of the honor cultures, Islamic cultures, for example, and you got to think about like Japan, like feudal Japan kind of thing. I think they still kind of have an honor culture, don't they? It can lead to some unproductive behaviors, such as excessive violence.
Honor killing?
Yeah. So in terms of its those kind of expressions, I don't know if that's like, if you have an honor system or an honor culture, are you doomed to fall into those pitfalls of excessive violence, or is there a way to do it better? I don't know. That's an interesting question.
So yeah, that's the thing I think is interesting, is we would basically immediately take that system to the extreme. Like, here's the extreme ways it's worked out in really destructive ways. But Western understandings of right and wrong have worked their ways out into like extreme things that were really terrible also, and really utilitarian and violent. And so I guess, I don't know, like I almost feel like it's not super beneficial to judge it by the extreme expression of it, because there are all sorts of small, more tribal cultures that are functioning that way really effectively.
Another one of Peterson's big criticisms, right, of talking about objective truth in the, not the honor way, but the other way, has a tendency to lead to totalitarianism. So he has this frustrating insistence on redefining the word truth, which he, if you listen to his two interviews, he has two interviews with Sam Harris on this podcast, and all they do is argue about epistemology the whole time, and it's super frustrating because Peterson has so many good things to say, and he's so interesting, and this one stupid point that he won't let go, and Harris wouldn't let it go. But so there are some negative extremes on the other end too. So maybe the problem is that human beings suck in general.
I think that's the holdover from Christian background.
We're falling and all that jazz.
Yeah, yeah.
But I definitely see that prior confirmed in the way I see the world.
So here's what I think is interesting about the potential of a collectivistic morality that's based on honor shame versus an individualistic morality that's based on introspection, right?
Like a socialist.
Well, yeah. An individualistic morality is based, it's based on subjective introspection. Its assumption is that you have the ability to rightly discern and to model things out and to make decisions about what's right and wrong accurately. And the entire rest of society is relying on you to be able to make those decisions accurately. But the converse is, like, it's almost the collectivist take on it almost has more of a safety net, because basically you're held accountable to the entire community around you to be like, no, you got that one wrong. That's unacceptable. And like the entire community has essentially authority to police things and like puts, I mean, I don't know. It just, that seems really interesting to me. It seems like almost like a higher accountability system.
Yeah, I can see that. And part of me kind of likes that. Yeah. But I, like I said, I also see some bad expressions of that.
Yeah. Because that's the thing is once the culture's locked onto something destructive as morally right, then it's almost like mob mentality and you can't, one person can't come and reason them back because everyone's, that's not how they understand things. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the problem is when you're getting this meta about it, I mean, if you give humans the reins, they'll screw it up in one way or the other. So, I mean, I think you can make either system work. I mean, if you had like a benevolent dictator, you could make it work or something.
And that's basically heaven, so.
but yeah, just, we can muck anything up.
Yeah. That's a great note to wrap up on.
Well, I'm really interested in this book. It sounds really cool.
Yeah.
I hope they have an audiobook version. I'll definitely listen to it or read it. I'll read it.
Okay. So let's plan that. Let's do another episode and talk about it.
Okay. Sounds good.
Do we have anything else we want to talk about good and bad?
Conversation was good.
Yeah.
Didn't go too bad.
The distraction from the dog was pretty bad.
Yeah, there you go.
Definitely decreased some utility.
Yeah.
But it probably was good for him.
Oh, well, those of you who requested that Andy be a permanent host, this is your fix. Enjoy it. Andy, thanks so much for hanging out with us. It's cool. We will have you back again.
Yeah, I would love to come back again. I enjoy talking to you guys and talking about these kind of things in general. Because like I said, I don't have much of an outlet in the rest of my life. I paint all day and I listen to books and things. And it's nice to have an outlet to talk and discuss and such.
Well, guys, as always, if you have any thoughts, concerns, questions, cries of outrage, hit us up. We're on social media. You can
PBRcast.
Yeah, on Twitter and Facebook, or you can hit up me and Josh on personal stuff. Andy, do you use social media? Do you use that stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I got a Facebook page, a personal one, and a business one, and Andrew and Gracia. Look me up.
Yeah. So
are you the only one in the world?
Yeah. I'm sure there's some more of us running around out there.
So hit us up with questions, comments, and as always, you can email us, pbrcast@gmail.com. Let's give a quick shout out to Keenly. Thanks for letting us use your awesome music on our crappy podcast. We desperately need this, guys. So thanks for that. We've mentioned before also Travis Teal Page, his music. If you're into that kind of Americana rock singer-songwriter deal, that's his vein. He's actually doing a tour, like down to Texas and back, which would be kind of cool. So hit him up, see those tour dates. They're playing if you're here in St. Louis, they're playing Blueberry Hill. It'll be a cool show. So, is the Duck Room Blueberry Hill? I think he's playing the Duck Room. I don't know. Somewhere over there. You can look them up. It'll be cool. Well, cool, man. On that note, I guess I'm gonna go listen to Sam Harris's podcast because I'm a heretic. I couldn't come up with anything better.
I guess I'm gonna go read a T.S. Lewis devotional. I'm a good Christian.
Oh, awesome. Ha ha ha.